You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Share music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Of the new generating capacity around the world last year came from sun and wind and batteries. The numbers are truly astonishing. The Earth is generating a third more power from the sun this summer than it did last summer. China was putting up 3 gigawatts of solar panels a day. A gigawatt's the rough equivalent of a large coal-fired power plant. California, fourth largest economy in the world, from winter into early summer was using 40% less natural gas to make electricity than they had 2 years prior.
That's Bill McKibben, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Bill McKibben on the clean energy revolution. 2024 was the hottest year ever recorded. 2025 will probably be even worse. Our planet is heating up. If present trends continue, a UN panel of scientists says it would be disastrous for humankind. Fossil fuels, including coal, are major contributors to global warming. So what is the regime in Washington doing about it? It's promoting fossil fuels with its mantra-like chants, clean, beautiful coal, and drill, baby, drill. However, energy from the sun and wind is cheaper, more reliable, and better for the climate. And it's growing faster than any energy source in history. Bill McKibben says, quote, "Our liberations and our destruction are arriving at precisely the same time. Everything is going wrong except this one big thing. Our species, at what feels like a dark moment, can take a giant leap into the light of the sun." Our guest today is Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. He's a leading environmental activist. He's the recipient of the Gandhi Peace Prize and the Right Livelihood Award. He's the founder of Third Act, which organizes people over the age of 60 for action on climate justice. He's the author of many books. His latest is Here Comes the Sun. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late September. And now, Bill McKibben, the clean energy revolution.
Always a particular pleasure to be in Boulder. I remember many trips here over the years, but I remember particularly, I think, coming in 2011, when Occupy was at its height, and I was helping out by sort of visiting Occupy encampments around the country and talking to people and whatever, and it was all fun and, you know, but very, you know, New York, down Zuccotti Park, downtown, very gritty and, you know, and place after place. And Boulder was the 15th or 20th of these that I'd gotten to. And I got there and I gave my talk. And at the end, they gave me a gift bag with all kinds of nice lip balm and stuff. And I thought, no, I'm in Boulder now, you know. This is where we are. On the other hand, you have me in an unexpectedly, for me, chipper frame of mind. My job for many years has essentially been to bum people out, to be a kind of roving Cassandra of one kind or another. And you would think that this would be the perfect moment for some more of that, because the world is in a darker place than I ever remember it. You know, all the things that I wrote about in The End of Nature almost 40 years ago, which was the first book about what we then called the greenhouse effect, all that stuff's more or less happening. In fact, it's playing out even more dramatically and quickly than we would have guessed. We now see, you know, real and deep damage to the most fundamental systems on the planet. The jet stream and the Gulf Stream are faltering and flickering. And faltering and flickering to our democracy in ways that would have been inconceivable to me at any other point in my life, even in the first Trump administration. There's a craziness to it all that, you know, knocks me awake many a morning at 3 o'clock, just pondering what to do and how to deal with it. And probably never more so than today, when the President of the United States gave the single most bonkers speech in the history of the United Nations. Not the longest speech, that was Fidel Castro in 1960, not the most provocative, I guess, that was Nikita Khrushchev banging his shoe on the podium at the UN, but definitely the craziest speech. And in some ways, profoundly, profoundly embarrassing for Americans to have this in a way that I've never quite felt before. So, a very, very dark moment, and yet there is one big good thing happening all of a sudden on planet Earth, and it's big enough and good enough that I think it stands some chance of taking a bite out of both the climate crisis and the authoritarianism crisis. And that one big good thing is this very sudden, over the last 36 months or so, very rapid, dramatic, surging rise in clean energy around the Earth. Now, of course, in places like Boulder, there's always been people with solar panels, and we've always known about alternative energy and, you know, on and on and on. I've had them on my house for a quarter century and so on. But it was always kind of off in its own, kind of off at the children's table of energy, you know. And all of a sudden, it's not alternative in the least. 95% of the new generating capacity around the world last year came from sun and wind and batteries. The numbers are truly astonishing. The Earth is generating a third more power from the sun this summer than it did last summer. China in May, which is the last month for which we have good numbers, in May, China was putting up 3 gigawatts of solar panels a day. A gigawatt's the rough equivalent of a large coal-fired power plant, bigger than the one that used to be here in Boulder, I think. So they were putting up the solar equivalent of that every 8 hours across China. California, which took this stuff seriously, California passed some kind of tipping point about 14 months ago. Now, almost every day, they generate more than 100% of the power they use for long periods of the day from the sun and the wind and hydro. At night, when the sun goes down, the biggest source of supply on the California grid are batteries, which weren't there 3 years ago, but that have been soaking up excess sunshine all afternoon. California, fourth largest economy in the world, from winter into early summer was using 40% less natural gas to make electricity than they had 2 years prior. So that's the kind of number, big enough to start, if it's applied around the world, not stopping global warming. It is way too late for that. As you know, this audience knows better than any other, there's no audience in the world more educated about the science of climate than people in this town. Too late to stop global warming, but not too late, perhaps, to start knocking tenths of a degree off how hot the planet's eventually going to get. And every tenth of a degree Celsius that we raise the temperature at this point moves 100 million of our brothers and sisters from a safe climate zone into a dangerous one. So this is the most important task that humans have ever undertaken. And finally, for the first time, we have a scalable tool that will help us undertake it. Finally, for the first time, there's at least some hope that we can start driving down the amount of carbon that we're pouring into the atmosphere. So in that sense, a very beautiful moment. It was about 5 years ago that we crossed some invisible line where it became cheaper to produce energy from pointing a sheet of glass at the sun than from burning coal and oil and gas. That was an epochal moment for our species. Humans have been happily setting things on fire for at least 700,000 years. Mostly a good idea. You know, we learned to cook food. That gave us the big brain. Questionable whether that was a helpful advance or not. But, you know, we were able to move north and south from the equator. Many fewer people living along the Front Range before they invented fire. The anthropologists even think that standing around the campfire for eons upon eons helped build the social bonds that mark our species, a kind of proto-Zoom, you know. And then when we learned to control the combustion of coal and gas and oil, that was modernity. I mean, that's the Industrial Revolution that created everything that we know around us. But the cost is now too high to continue. The cost, obviously, in terms of the climate system, which is on the edge of collapse and which we have only the shortest amount of time. It's not just the climate system, though. You know, 9 million human beings die every year, one death in five on this planet, from breathing the combustion byproducts of fossil fuel, those particulates that lodge in the lungs. There's 5 million school children in New Delhi. 2.5 million of them have irreversible lung damage from breathing the air. Not necessary anymore. And there's the eternal problem of the fact that when you rely on a scarce resource that's only available in a few places, the people who control those places end up with way more power than they should have. I mean, the first guy to figure this out was our first real plutocrat, John D. Rockefeller. And, you know, now are the biggest oil and gas barons in America for the last three decades have been the Koch brothers. They control the most refining and pipeline capacity. They use their winnings to systematically erode our democracy. If you wonder why it was so easy for Donald Trump to kick it over, it was because they'd sawed off a lot of the supports over the last few decades. In Europe, the biggest oil and gas baron is Vladimir Putin, you know, last week using his winnings to send drones to probe the defenses of Poland. A sentence that should send a chill down the spine of anyone who remembers the 20th century. It's beautiful to imagine a world where everybody can produce the energy that they need in the place where they are. It's beautiful. It's painful and beautiful to contemplate how different the history of the last 100 years would have been if oil had been of trivial value in that period. The number of wars and coups and assassinations and terrorist plots and things that would have been avoided. So this is a fundamentally gorgeous moment for human beings, a chance for a real reorientation of the world around us. It's not a free lunch. There are no free lunches, but there are definitely more expensive and less expensive lunches, and this falls directly into the latter category. Yeah, you have to go mine some stuff in order to build batteries and solar panels and things, but the difference is so obvious when you think about it that it really should sort of help set your mind at ease. You go mine some lithium and you put it in a battery and there it works for a very long time, decades probably. And when the battery degrades, we now are able to recycle the lithium and it's valuable enough that we do and take it out and start making the next battery. When you go mine some coal, you set it on fire and have to mine some more the next day. That's why your neighbors up at the Rocky Mountain Institute did a study last September saying that all the mining that we'd need to do between now and 2050 for this renewable battery energy transition was less than the volume of coal we mined on this planet last year. A way to keep it in your mind is a boatload full of solar panels over its lifetime will produce 500 times the energy that a boatload full of coal or oil or gas will produce. It's a completely different thing that we're talking about now. It's basically the application of human ingenuity that is the resource that we're using to capture the sunlight that streams onto the world every day. We started down this path in 1954 in Edison, New Jersey at Bell Labs. There might be one or two people in this room old enough to have helped fund this work by dropping dimes in payphones in their youth, you know. We almost got there in the 1970s when Jimmy Carter, engineer, wanted to deal with the oil crisis by turning to the sun. And he came to Golden, Colorado to give the speech that should have launched the solar era. It was pouring rain that day. Typical, I'm afraid, of Mr. Carter's luck. But not only did he put solar panels on the White House roof, he put money in his final budget sufficient to do the research that they reckoned would allow America to provide 20% of its power from the sun by the year 2000. And had we done that, we would live on a very different planet, a much cooler one. We didn't do that. Ronald Reagan was elected instead, took down those solar panels, committed us to the path of drilling for oil as the way out of all things. The next great moment came not in the U.S., but in Germany at the turn of the century. The Green Party, which in European parliamentary systems, unlike ours, the Green Party is a very useful thing. The Green Party used its leverage as the balance of power to get what we called the Energiewende, the energy transition underway, and the German government agreed to pay large sum to people who put solar panels on their roof. They'd buy the electricity back at a high price. And that expensive work of the German government created the demand that allowed the Chinese to start to get good at making solar panels cheaply, and people just got better and better and better at it. And now we're at this place where it's really possible to see a different future. I think maybe the most beautiful story comes from Pakistan. Pakistan been harder hit by climate change than any country on earth. It gets to be 125, 126 routinely now in its big cities in the summer, right at the edge of human survival. They've had the two greatest floods since Noah in 2010 and 2022. But they have one deep geographical advantage in this case, which is a long border with China. And that meant that as the Chinese overproduced solar, cheap solar panels, they were flooding across the border. People who 3 years ago were, you know, importing rice or cement or something turned their entrepreneurial talents to solar panels, and they found a ready audience because the electric grid in Pakistan is expensive and unreliable. And so without government help, just people basically going on YouTube and TikTok and watching videos with Hindustani music in the background, Pakistanis last year managed to build in 8 months the equivalent of something like half the country's national electric grid. They imported 17 gigawatts worth of solar panels last year. That's a huge amount of energy. Pakistani farmers were early adopters. Those of you who've traveled in rural Asia know that the soundtrack for that part of the world is the cough and hum of the diesel generators that are running the pumps to pull the water up from the deep tube wells that are the residue of the Green Revolution of the 1960s. That diesel's often the biggest input on a farmer's budget. So they were happy to have these solar panels. They usually lacked the money to build the metal supports we're familiar with. So they just laid them on the ground, pointed them at the sun. Pakistani farmers last year used 35% less diesel than they did the year before. Now that same thing's starting to happen across Africa. In the last 6 months, we've seen huge increase, really on any place where there's a strong Chinese trade route, where people are, there's 600 million people in Africa without electricity at all. Fossil fuel failed to provide it, despite 250 years of opportunity. So now people are getting their first modern energy by putting up village-scale microgrids in place after place after place, and it's incredibly beautiful to watch. And beautiful to watch all the things that quickly come afterwards. In somewhat more affluent parts of the developed world, that's often the EV. We think of Detroit as the center of automotive technology on this planet. No more. The most important car cities are two or three places in China whose names are hard for me to pronounce, but they're producing the best and cheapest cars on the planet. They're also producing, and many other places now, huge quantities of e-bikes, which may turn out to be the even more spectacular invention that comes from this. A bicycle is a pretty good invention to begin with, and I know that Boulderites are deeply serious about their spandex and their, you know. But to have invented a bicycle without hills is a pretty remarkable, you know, thing, and that's what we now have. The heat pump replacing the furnace in people's basement and the air conditioner in their window, the induction cooktop. I'm the cook in my family, so I've for many years had, cost me $60 on Amazon, induction cooktop boils water twice as fast as the, you know, gas stove that I used most of my life. And I wish I'd known this when my child was young, if you have a gas stove in the kitchen, your kid has a 50% better chance of getting asthma, which if you think about it is not a great shock because what you have is a campfire in your kitchen, which is not a good thing. All these things are elegant and beautiful. I've been hearing from friends, I haven't been to China for 18 months, but I've been hearing from people regularly now that you can easily tell the difference in Beijing and Shanghai, that it's not only cleaner, it's way, way quieter in the middle of the city than it used to be. Because way more than half the cars sold in China now come with a plug out the back. All of it's beautiful and at very deep levels, except if you own a coal mine or an oil well, at which point it's the ugliest development possible because it threatens to take the reserves that you have carefully hoarded away and render them valueless in a pretty short period of time, which explains a lot about what's happened in American politics in the last 18 months. If I know that California was using 40% less natural gas, you can be assured that Chevron and Exxon and everybody else down in the Permian Basin knew it too. When Donald Trump as candidate told oil executives that for the low, low price of $1 billion in campaign donations, they could have anything that they wanted. And he said it, as is his wont, quite openly. They went to work and they raised about $500 million between donations and advertising and lobbying expenses in the last election cycle. And that was clearly enough because we now have in this country a administration unique in the world, doing everything it can to slow down this transition and prevent it from happening. The scale of that effort is almost beyond comprehension. They closed down work on a 80% completed wind farm off the coast of Rhode Island 3 weeks ago. Federal court told them yesterday that they couldn't, but of course they're going to appeal it to the Supreme Court, where all bad ideas go to be ratified at this point in our history. It's truly crazy what we're doing. When American historians look back at the last 6 months, they'll describe it as a period of the kind of rise of fascism in America. When world historians look at it, the thing that they will say, I think, is that this was the period when the West ceded technological, economic, and probably with it political primacy to China in the course of a very few months. It's a period like no other. But we desperately need to make sure that the U.S. doesn't become such a caboose on this train that it holds the whole world back. That's what they're trying to do. To understand why we're putting tariffs on everything, an easy primer is the fact that we're using them as leverage to make people buy large quantities of liquefied natural gas from the Gulf of Mexico. Gulf of Mexico. We made the Europeans pledge to buy $750 billion and the Japanese $500 billion and on and on and on. This may work in the short run. It may not, too. I don't think they'll actually follow through on all those purchases. But in the even slightly longer run, there's not a country on earth that wants to have its energy supply dependent on a supplier as fickle and erratic as the United States, not when they could just go buy a bunch of Chinese solar panels and rely instead on the sun, which has faithfully come up every morning so far, you know? Three weeks ago, Indonesia, fourth largest country in the world, announced plans to build 100 gigawatts of solar power over the next 5 years. That was an important tell, I think, about where things are going. In order to push things in America, we need, as usual, to organize and try and make it happen. We can't wait for the sheer economics of this to win out, because that'll take a little longer than the planet has. 30 years from now, we will run the world on sun and wind because of economics, but if it takes us 30 years, or really anything like it, to get there, then the planet we run on sun and wind will be a broken planet. So that's why we organize. We had this beautiful day Two days ago, so many thanks for the people in this room who helped hard with Sun Day. There were 500 events around the world. The logo for Sun Day is half a sun. A really wonderful design team came up with it because it represents the fact that we're halfway there. And we have the technology, we need the political will to put it into effect. About 10,000 people so far have gone to the website at sunday.earth and drawn in their own version of that sun to go with it. And I hope you will too. There's Jane Fonda's that she sent in from the Amazon when I asked. And they're just beautiful. And they're just, you know, the images from the other day were profound and wonderful. They're just beginning to flow in. I think that's Portland, Oregon. That's there I was in Lower Manhattan, where we had really profound day of talk and action. But just beautiful pictures from around the country. So grateful to everybody, because simply in this case, spreading the message is exceptionally helpful. This is a fight that we can win because people are inclined in this way already. The support for clean energy, which is enormous when we poll about it, crosses all partisan and ideological lines pretty easily.
You're listening to Bill McKibben on the Clean Energy Revolution. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Texas is the now fastest moving clean energy state in the country. And big oil tried to beat this back at the Texas legislature last session. They had a whole bunch of bills that people thought would pass. The most prominent was one that the newspapers were calling DEI for natural gas, because if you were going to put up five